May your broadband speed never waver. May your laptop stand the pace. May the mighty bytes of cyberspace never lose their digi-pace. But of all the things we wish for thee, the truest of them all is to share the fun and reap the joy of the midweek drive through all. Oh, wow. Can I do that in an Irish accent? May your broadband speed never waver. May your laptop stand the pace. May the mighty bytes of cyberspace never lose their digi-pace. But of all the things we wish for thee, the truest of them all is to share the fun and reap the joy of the midweek drive through all.
Okay, but I thought you were going to do it in an Irish accent.
Well, happy Shakespeare Day. Happy St. George's Day. And indeed, happy Shakespeare's birthday day. And what better way to celebrate the joys of Shakespeare's birthday than indeed that awesomely talented writer of course, John Dee. We know Illyria is one of the awesome texts of the year so far. It's Armin Shimerman. How are you, Armin?
I'm very fine. Very happy to be with you on Shakespeare's birthday.
Well, it's always a delight to feature your good self and also to put you together with another fine writer who I'm sure if Shakespeare was alive today, he would have said, I want to write like Arthur Weingarten in the joys of the Green Hornet, the Addams Family, all sorts of other things. Arthur, welcome again for your usual monthly slot with us. How are you?
Bless you. You're the only one I know who could put us in the same universe.
It's there, Arthur. I've no doubt. Murder, She Wrote will be there. Could always be written for Lady M. That's what I say. Also joining us from the joys of the University of Lincoln, of course, we've got two fabulous folk. First of all, the wonderful Rebecca Bond. How are you, Rebecca?
I'm very well. Lovely to see you all.
Excellent. And Armin, another huge fan of your incarnation in a certain Star Trek series. Yes, of course, we're talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. It's Vicky Wright. How are you, Vicky?
Okay. How are you?
Excellent. We're nice fine. Jessica Burtis is also joining us from the joys of North Carolina as well. Vicky, I mean, I'm not going to be ageist here, but I suspect you were too young to catch Deep Space Nine first time round. So what is it about Star Trek in particular that appeals and why you were so excited when I said, Armin Shimerman is joining us again today?
I don't know what it is about Star Trek that appealed, but I remember watching the reruns on the BBC. I just love the adventure, and I'm just a massive sci-fi and fantasy fan anyway. But also, I'm a massive Buffy fan as well. So I
covered two of those fandoms. Okay.
Yes.
which is wonderful stuff. And of course, as we've said, Armin, in so many ways, Star Trek uses the Shakespearean line, not only with respect to using Shakespearean actors and stage-trained actors in terms of the shows, but also a lot of the messages have that Shakespearean ethic.
They do, and I don't know if I'm right about this or not, but I do believe because of the technicality of the language, which we call technobabble, they needed actors that could master the difficulty of the language. And as you said, they seem to prefer classical actors who've had a background in that and experience with that.
I mean, Arthur, sharing your thoughts as a producer and all range of things. Personally, I think if we could have a time machine, Armin would be ideal for the mod squad. I'm just putting that out there as a sort of possibility from that point of view. But any thoughts that you've got on this whole field?
He would certainly have elevated it, I'll tell you that.
It was one of my favorites growing up, so thank you for that.
Right. I know that I have to be wrong about this. I always think of it as Henry IV, but I'm a poor fool who would live. That's when in a jail sequence somewhere. The only reason I mention that I'm a poor fool who would live is whenever I'm compared to someone whom I think is out of my universe, that's the only thing I can fall back on, is that kind of humbleness. But you certainly would have been welcome, I'll tell you that.
Thank you. That's That's very nice indeed. I wish we could go back and right. do that.
I'm sure there must be a time machine somewhere that we can work on for that basis, but that's for another line. But going back, I mean, what is it about Shakespeare, Armin, in particular, that has always appealed to your good self? I mean, you're a scholar, you're an academic, you've written extensively about the Bard and so on. You've written about his fictional life, obviously, in John Dee from that point of view. So what is it that still captures the magic from your own point of view?
I imagine it's two things. Certainly, it's the language, the use of the language. I mean, we have lots of wonderful writers, not only in the English language, but in other languages. But the thing about Shakespeare for me as an English-speaking person is the way he puts words together, the way he uses rhetoric, the way he uses imagery, the way he borrows from other writers and makes their words better. That, in addition to his incredible knowledge of the human condition, of what it meant to be human. And I learn from that every time I read a play. There's something new that reminds me of how wonderful it is to be alive.
Would you echo that from your own experience, Arthur, in terms of the longevity of the individual?
Well, there's, you know, I mean, first of all, there's an embarrassment of riches if you want to go into Shakespeare and then steal from him to put it onto anyone from Adam's family to this and that. But therein lies the genius, because in all of the plays, in all of the sonnets, every single one of them is what would be called a storyline. That you could adapt and in this transfigure it in certainly to the diminishment of poor Shakespeare if we used it, but nevertheless, I myself have used over the years in all of the scripts I've written elements of Shakespeare, because as was just said, the originality, the it's like 26 keys on a piano. Why is it that we have such an infinite amount of music coming out of 26 keys, or 88 keys rather, or 26 alphabet in our alphabet? But look what he did. He could take an idea and turn it like Picasso into a fragmented thing in which you have 100 new ideas out of one thing. So, I'm so happy every time I stole from him.
And I will remind you that he stole from others.
Yes, exactly.
Except for one play, all the plays are based on other people's work. And many of his lines are based on other people's language. But as you said, Arthur, he makes it better and richer, more memorable, and more creative.
Yeah, yeah. I think often in today's world with the pandemic and this and that, when he talks about troubles, when troubles come, they come not as single spies, but in battalions now.
Single soldiers. If they come not in single soldiers.
But... Yes, single soldiers, but in battalions, yes. I mean, who would come up with that? Who else would come up with that concept?
And he puts it in the mouth of the villain of the play.
Yeah.
So that all of his characters are three-dimensional. That's not coming from Hamlet. It's coming from King Claudius.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, normally I would hang my head in shame if I were caught stealing from someone else, but I think it's an honor to steal from him.
It makes perfect sense. Let's bring in some of our younger folk, et cetera. Jessica, we'll turn to your good self in North Carolina. You're listening to this whole sequence. You're an English scholar, of course, yourself. What are your views on Shakespeare? Do you have any questions for either Arthur or indeed Armin at present?
Well, I have to agree. I think that something that I love about Shakespeare is just like he created so many words. And I think that's so interesting that this one person added so much to the English language and had such an impact. And I think part of what we like about him is he's such a mystery, but then he provided so much, you know, these iconic stories. So I love hearing this. And if I could ask Armin and actually all of you, I'm very curious, what was your first interaction with Shakespeare? Like, when was the first time that you guys actually came in contact with, like, a Shakespeare work?
My answer to that is manifold. There are many answers to that, because I really don't remember the very first. I do remember reading Hamlet as a very young man, but I don't remember being impressed by it. I think I was most impressed when, as a young man, my school sent me to Princeton to see a production of Twelfth Night. And I remember being very enthused by the idea of seeing a live play. I'd never seen one before. This was my first. I was inundated with the experience, and as well as the language, the material, the performances. So I think that may have been the original inspiration. And ironically, in that production, I found out years later, was there was an actor who introduced me to my wife. I worked with him years later on Broadway in a show called I Remember Mama. His name is George Hearn. But he was in that first play that I saw of Twelfth Night. And he came back to inspire me again by introducing me to my wife, Kitty.
That is such a sweet origin story. That's so cute. Oh, I love that.
It's a whole new world. In fact, it was only a matter of hours ago that actually we were connecting with the person who introduced you to the whole program, Armin, which is Patricia Tolman, currently house-sitting in Hawaii. And it's a tough life, obviously, when you're working through that process, but never mind. Rebecca, we were sharing, of course, our experience of Shakespeare. I think you also had a similar sort of notion in terms of the first time you encountered Shakespeare, really, and seeing it live on the stage.
Well, the first time I encountered Shakespeare in written form, I always grew up with books in our house. We had hundreds of them. But as a very young child, I remember we had this set of Shakespeare books that were made to look appealing to children on the front. And I'm talking, I was very young at this age too. So that obviously appealed to me. And it was simplified, I think, the storylines inside. But as I grew up with those, I wanted to read more. So I went on to read the actual plays and I just couldn't stop from there. And we study them quite extensively in school as you grow up as well. So I've always been exposed to them. And I think I was always that student that could not wait for the Shakespeare lessons, whereas everyone else was a bit sort of like, oh, Shakespeare again. But I was in love with these plays. I love studying them in depth. And I did actually watch a performance of King Lear at the Globe a couple of years ago, I think now. And it was the best thing I've ever seen, honestly. The way it's brought to life on stage is just incredible. And you just can't beat Shakespeare. As you say, it's a classic. It's iconic. It will live, you know, eternally. It's work that's here to stay. I love it.
The first Shakespeare production I actually saw was Henry IV, Part One. Before then, I think I'd actually sort of had the routine of going through Julius Caesar and, of course, Henry IV, Part One and so on as a kind of rote learning thing and working through that process. When you do see a good production, I emphasize it has to be a good production, it does make it come alive. And I think this is something, Armin, which is critical, presumably in your teaching as well. It's got to have that sense of aliveness to really kind of connect, I would have thought.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. The reason a lot of people don't like Shakespeare is they've seen too many bad productions. There are a lot of bad productions of Shakespeare out there, whether it's time or money or incentive. I'm not quite sure what the reason is. But many times productions do not do the sort of research and explorations that is needed to communicate what is basically difficult language. Actually, if you look at it after a while, it's not that difficult. But in first blush, it seems difficult. And so audiences get put off because the actors, the production, are not doing their job of providing you a really satisfying theatrical experience.
Let's turn to Vicky. Vicky, it's just your second midweek drive. Your first one was earlier today, of course, so throwing you in at the deep end here. What are your views in terms of Shakespeare? I mean, again, you know, I know I've been taking you for the science fiction class in English this particular semester, but in terms of, you know, this grandest theme, scheme of things, what are your thoughts on this whole area?
I've had a bit of an up and down relationship with Shakespeare because when I was at school, I think it was just the way it was taught at school. I didn't understand it. I really struggled to understand it. As a teenager, we did like a modernized version of it. And I actually took part in that. So I think I've been in more Shakespeare plays than I've seen because I haven't seen any live. I've seen one or two, like the RSC version of Othello on that DVD. But since I've been studying literature, I've really come to understand it and really appreciate the way language is used in it. And that is the thing that I really do like, is that sense that a lot of our modern language now, the way we use language, comes from Shakespeare.
Vicky, have you studied rhetoric?
No.
Study rhetoric. Shakespeare will be much, much clearer to you.
Okay, thank you.
That's the kind of expertise that it's wonderful, incalculable. I was just going to say, Armin, that thank the Lord for Principal Snyder at least had some Shakespearean sort of ethos in terms of Buffy, but it all connects together, let alone Boston Legal.
Thank you very much. They cast an actor for his background or his experience, or perhaps the way he looks, and all of that comes into play. Arthur can tell you that better than anyone, that in the casting process, all of those things come in the door and you recognize, is that what I want or is that not what I want right now?
Arthur, over to you. True. Is that the process?
Yeah, that's very true. But what I'm always have been struck by the fact that when Shakespeare was Shakespeare, extant in his life, his audiences appreciated his language and understood it. There was no distance as such, so that even if, I don't know if the butcher and the baker went to see his plays, I have no idea if that was
their
true.
Their apprentices did.
Excuse me?
Their apprentices did.
Yeah.
Their apprentices did.
Yes. Yeah, right. But but the fact of the matter is that he did not bend his views, language, constructs, and all, to reach a small audience. He was an entrepreneur. He was a producer of popular plays, and he wanted to sell tickets. Therefore, he could not have an alienation of an audience by, but look what we've done with it today. We have elevated it to such a point that it's like the Republicans won't get vaccines because we have so removed ourselves from his world, from listening to language that is magnificent to the terrible of if you parse a sentence today, there's one word that isn't that. Where have we taken a wrong turn? I don't know.
If I may add to what Arthur just said, and I totally agree with him, one of the great things about Shakespeare is his arguments. Most of the plays are arguments. Each character is making an argument for what they want, what they hope to see, what they think is righteous. And so people listen to arguments, Arthur. You're absolutely right, back in because they were constantly bombarded with it. And as you're saying about the modern age, certainly here in the United States, people are not trained to listen to arguments anymore. They'll get a bit and then they'll move on. And that is a problem with the modern age and with people, excuse me, who don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. The attention span is a fruit fly, life, that in itself. But where, at what point, and you would know it, I don't, I'm just throwing it out, at what point did we diverge from wanting to have language like that to the absolute absence of any grace or any allusion to a thought that goes deeper than the present tense?
Well, Arthur, I would argue with you a little. I'm sure there are writers out there, I certainly know of some, that aspire to that. So it's not like we've lost it completely. It is there. But I would say, and going back to what I said to Vicky, I would say part of the not appreciating arguments and language and its facility and its beauty sort of went out of American anyway education around the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, when the study of rhetoric, which very few people study anymore, went out. And that's what rhetoric teaches, is all the things that you are saying we're lacking now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Well, it used to be, and I had it in my public school in Brooklyn, declaiming. We used to have to get up once a week and declaim a poem, a verse piece, whatever it was. And so that in itself was a training ground for even those who didn't graduate from high school. They were exposed to it.
Yes, so they had an argument.
Or if there is, it's such a paucity that it's to be almost non-existent. People are satisfied to have a language that has absolutely no romanticism, no grace to it.
Honestly, no. Arthur, I mean, I'll be saying hashtag shocked next. Unbelievable. I'll fire that briefly. I'll give you an example of what I consider to be a wonderful, exquisite use of language, really. It's just one paragraph, so I'll take it from now. A stinging Atlantic rain pelts the old wooden structures at Mortlake with full-throated clatter. Dr. D glances at the meandering streams on his windows, taking his mind off the impending meeting with the young Warwickshire playwright, Shakespeare. Will be arriving shortly, his third visit. Here in the Externa Bibliotheca, where Dee received guests, he intends to convince the young lads to give up London and follow him to Illyria. The library is what the boy is after, but the library, and certainly the precious volumes of the Interna Bibliotheca, shall not be travelling abroad. So the strategy will be to convince Master Shakespeare that access to the librarian is more valuable. A tenuous thesis. Not my words, but the words of Armin Shimerman. But that's really true.
Well done. Beautifully written. Yes, that's wonderful. Good.
So you see, quality writing is still there. Armin, over to you.
All I can say is thank you. Thank you, ever thanks. I was inspired by the works of Shakespeare. I was inspired by the life of John Dee, and I tried to put them both together in the novel that you're quoting from.
Yeah, well, you did a beautiful job.
Let's turn back to the team again. Rebecca, any thoughts or questions you've got that you want to put forward to either Arthur or indeed Armin?
I'd love to. I think Shakespeare as a character, not only his works, are very, very fascinating because very little is known about his life, as we know. So what kind of degree of research goes into producing a work on Shakespeare? What kind of research had to go into that? Because obviously there's very little out there, and I'm sure it was quite a hard task to try and piece together all these unknown parts of his life.
Well, I can only tell you it's a lifetime of research. Long before I ever had any interest in writing, as a Shakespearean actor, I had to do a lot of research for the plays and the parts that I was playing. Then I, because of a wonderful teacher I had back at UCLA where I went to school, I became fascinated, as perhaps some of you are, by the Bard and his language and what he was saying. So it was a lifetime of research. But I don't think a day has gone by since I graduated from school, and that was a long time ago, that I haven't done some reading about the period and about the playwright. I am equally interested in the period as I am in the playwright. The playwright was just one of many people who lived at that time. Shakespeare is the most famous, perhaps not as famous as Queen Elizabeth, perhaps less famous than Queen Elizabeth, but certainly comparable. And because of my interest in that, it all sort of comes vomiting out as I write. And it is my aspiration to try, when I write dialogue, to give you a taste of what that language may have sounded like from people who lived at that time. As Arthur was saying, people did not have a problem at that time of understanding as much as we do.
So fascinating. And I think you can never learn enough, can you? So as you say, if you keep reading, you'll find there's always something to learn.
I love the notion of you being a passionate bardologist, Armin. I mean, that's just what works so many ways. It's really great. Well,
and it's rather cheeky of me to write a book about Shakespeare and about the Elizabethan period, because obviously from my accent, that is not my culture.
I don't know. I mean, it was just a little a confusion of George III, I think, and a little bit of a tea incident. I think other than that, we'd all be one country. So we won't move too far away on that sort of system. Vicky, back to your good self. I mean, you chanced now to obviously throw any questions, either, say, the incarnation of Quark or indeed the incarnation of Principal Snyder. Go for it, my girl. Off you go, Vicky.
I just wanted to sort of comment on and maybe question, I'm not sure what the word is, but for me and my sort of generation, there's a whole generation of people who...
Born in the 21st century.
It's not, I'm older, slightly older than that, who sort of grew up and were big fans of Buffy and just knew it in passing. And I feel like that has had a massive impact on language, because there's a lot of words that, and ways of using words that that show sort of popularized, that are still in use now. And I hear now and I think, Buffy. Obviously it's not, I don't know. I mean, I'm just kind of drawing a comparison between that and the way Shakespeare maybe used language.
I think that's absolutely true, Vicky. I had no, many times I would read a script and I would get in touch with Joss or one of the writers and say, I don't know what that means. And then years later, I find myself using those expressions all the time. For instance, my bad, didn't understand that when I read it the first time. That is not necessarily a Buffy expression, although I think Buffy made that very popular, my bad. So yes, Joss and the writing team of that show were very much interested in here of imitating the language of teenagers at that time in America, and reproducing that in the show. And I think as much as they were dealing with the angst of teenagers in high school, they were also interested in using the vernacular that they heard around them and putting that in their scripts. I'm sure Arthur did that as well when he was producing shows as well and writing shows. But Buffy was very, very good about introducing vernacular into their shows. And it has now become part of our everyday language. Even people as old as I am sometimes speak like Buffy teenagers.
You know, Armin, you bring up a really interesting point. You say where I might have used the vernacular of the thing, let's say Mod Squad, which
Mod
was-
Mod Squad, absolutely.
Yeah, that kind of a thing. The truth of the matter is, yes, I and other writers have ears attuned to what is going on today, whatever that day is. And we tried to integrate it from the instinctive knowledge that you're trying to reach, like Shakespeare, the largest audience you possibly can do. You're not looking to be exclusionary. The problem was the censorship of the networks and the imposition of morality, a sense of morality. For example, let me give you this. As I was listening to you, I had a coda, the end of one of the scripts I wrote for Mod Squad, in which I said, Link kisses her long and deeply. That, yeah, facile kind of a way of getting out of something. And that's it, wrote the end. I get a note from the ABC network censor. Dear Arthur, thank you. The script was very nice and all that. One note only, which please make sure that it is not included in the broadcast. Now, this was just a descriptive line, no dialogue, nothing to appear. He said, long yes, deeply no. This is the, I mean, to reduce it to, you know, the ludicrous, this is it, language that was moved outside of the purview of those people, the red light, green light people, affected things that the audience had no idea of what was going on behind the camera. But we were sorely constrained not to do what we would like to do.
And do you not think, Arthur, along with the language, there's the shadow of racism in that as well?
Yes, without a doubt.
I'm assuming that Link was kissing a white woman, and yes, that was something the censors were concerned about.
Yes.
Go down the route of Plato's stepchildren. It was by Michelle Nichols and Bill Shatner, for goodness sakes.
Yes, right. Yeah. So we had to make that adjustment timed every single day and every single show. Sometimes the betterment of it. I'm not saying they were always wrong. They weren't. But for the most part, there is that Midwestern morality that was adhered to and it knocked out an awful lot of creativity.
I want to congratulate you because the Mod Squad was one of the first shows that I remember anyway, where racism was addressed. We had three people who were peers. There was one of the characters, Link was of color, person of color. And I think we all learned about racism. We all learned about the fact that everyone is an equal by watching Mod Squad.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Even as sanitized as it was more than what was being shown.
It was an important start. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I'm just looking forward, Arthur, in a couple of weeks' time when we actually put under the Forensic Resonance Rewind spotlight the Thresh Roulette affair for the Man from U.N.C.L.E. fourth season. Heaven only knows what will be discovered from that. Still, there we are. Jessica, as somebody who's... North Carolina, it's not really Midwest America, is it? No, not really, but no. Absolutely, sort of shaking your head there. Any thoughts or observations from your own perspective?
You're off by about a couple of thousand miles.
Yeah, you got to realize I'm a European, Arthur. I don't understand these things about you guys in America. It's a different world entirely.
I don't know. Bless you. So it's okay.
I'd love to go to the Midwest at some point. But I'm very curious, Armin, when you're discussing language, and I think Arthur touched on this with like and kind of, and how those have been included in language. So kind of to both of you, I just said kind of, I've heard some people say that language is becoming simplified and that, you know, as generations go on, English is kind of degrading almost and becoming a bit too homogenized. So do you think that's true? Would you say that you've seen that?
I would differ with that a little. I think the desire to increase one's vocabulary perhaps is getting minimalized. On the other hand, language like any language, English like any language, is always changing. We are getting technical words that are added to our vocabulary. COVID, for instance, was an unknown word to us 2 or 3 years ago, is now very much part of our language. The language is always evolving, always changing, always becoming more complex. The desire to be familiar with that language perhaps is decreasing, but the language itself, I think, is increasing and becoming more diverse.
Yes, but just think of this. The declarative sentence has almost vanished from language. Kind of, sort of, is a swimming away from what a person thinks. When I hear people put a sentence together and say, well, I was kind of upset when a gun was pointed at me. Well, what was the alternative? What was it that you're
become
feeling?
A speechwriter for Donald Trump, obviously, Arthur.
If you're kind of upset, what is it that you were? And of course they say, well, I'm upset. And so you ask, well, is that a vocalization while your brain tries to catch up with what's going on? Or is it literally, I do not want to declare myself? I find it extraordinary. The declarative sentence, he was hanged. Not he was sort of hanged.
Only partially. That's the other thing.
Only partially, right. Yeah.
Exactly. Before we actually head off, just very briefly, we mentioned this on Armin's previous production, of course, with us. And I do want to stress that, Armin, we have a great debt to thank you for, obviously, so does Arthur and indeed Annette and indeed the rest of the world, perhaps, because you also were the founder of the Trekkies or Trek Against Trump campaign. You got the Star Trek fans mobilized against the former president, did you not?
I did. I had a lot of help, but I was the originator of that, and I guess we didn't succeed.
Well, it's working through in one dimension. That's the important thing. So we carry on from there. Vicky, any closing thoughts from yourself?
Just the fact that I've really enjoyed it and highlight of my week.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you.
That's like pretty sure. Okay, Arthur, I think you can do this from your. I mean, you know, we do a monthly segment from yourself in San Diego, and obviously Annette is joining us next week, also from San Diego. So, would you like to throw those last two questions to Armin, please? Who's a relative novice? This is just his third show, so off you go, Arthur.
Armin, did you enjoy the show? Have you enjoyed doing it?
Which one, Star Trek?
No, this one.
Oh, this one.
Please, Alex. Alex, please call the supporting.
My apologies. Absolutely, Arthur. I wouldn't have come back if I didn't have a good time in the past two shows. I really enjoy it. I enjoy the people I meet. I enjoy the questions that Alex throws at us. And I very much enjoyed meeting you, Arthur, and the ladies as well. A good conversation about language is rare, and to participate in that is always something that I find ticklish.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. It's really a pleasure meeting you.
Vice versa. Arthur, has it been good for you as well? Have you enjoyed it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you've upped the game. I'm very happy to see it.
Always like to keep raising that bar.
Just to check Annette, who is sitting here, and she said she too thought it was wonderful. Yeah.
And you live, someone, you know, I think it was Vicky asked me about my first approach to Shakespeare. Well, certainly one of the most important approaches to Shakespeare was right there where you live, the San Diego Globe Shakespeare Festival.
Globe Shakespeare, the wonderful theater.
Which is an internationally famous and terrific theater. God bless you for having that in your backyard.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, I'm only new to San Diego. I lived in Los Angeles 40 some odd years and coming from New York there. But we've made a very happy transfer here. Do you know the area? Do you know?
I've lived there many times, worked in many of the theaters in San Diego. Very fond of San Diego. You're close to heaven there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
He's close to heaven because he married Annette Andre. That's another line entirely. Anyway, and that's joining us next week. So it goes, basically. It's almost as romantic as Taylor as your own sharing as to how you met up with Kitty, Armin, which is even, I mean, I think the screenplay needs to be written. I take it then, Armin and Arthur, you will be returning in the not too distant future?
Yes, absolutely.
If you build it, we will come.
Oh, yes.
It's a field of dreams moment, quite clearly. Rebecca, great as ever, connecting with your good self. We'll see you tomorrow morning, of course, for our film review. Jessica, good to see you as ever. See you again very soon. Likewise, Vicky, keep on keeping on. And don't forget, if you're looking for a text to read, Vicky, as a sort of graduation treat, etc., Betrayal of Angels, Illyria, Book One by Armin Shimerman. It will literally knock your socks off. I shall quote once again from Patricia Tolman yesterday. It finishes... She needs the next one. She needs the next one now. We do. We need the second one as well.
I'm working on it.
Armin Shimerman and Arthur Weingarten, Vicky Wright, Jessica Burtis and Rebecca Barnes. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and bye for now.
Jessica Burtis flying the flag for North Carolina across the solar system.
Did you know that in 1991, a bill was passed by the North Carolina Senate changing the official proportions of the state flag from a length one-third more than its width to a length one-half more than its width?
Wow, there must not be a lot going on in the North Carolina Senate for them to have that kind of time on their hands.
Well, it may well be that lockdown is beginning to be eased and we're heading off into the wide new world of travel and such like. But if we're driving cars, you need to bear in mind a few key aspects that are actually there. And who better to actually talk about than driving cars than, of course, our awesomely talented motorist extraordinaire, Jody Kidd. How are you, Jody?
I'm really good. How are you?
Yeah, splendid, actually. And obviously, I've still been pottering around. I haven't been doing the sort of 26,000 miles a year that one did pre-pandemic, of course. But clearly, in terms of that whole sequence, it is important to look after our vehicles. Otherwise, they might let us down at the most inopportune times.
I mean, absolutely. And this is... So I've been doing this research and survey with Co-op Insurance. And it's been quite interesting getting all the stats back. And that... like one of them, 46% of women have admitted to being really, really anxious to getting back on the road. And a quarter of men are also very, very anxious. And then there was one that was really interesting, which was 16 to 24 year olds. And I thought they would be the ones chomping at the bit to get out. But 64% of them, and this is the most anxious age group to emerge from the pandemic, saying that they are really scared about driving, and especially on busier roads. So basically, this is where I'm going to come in and try and help with a few tips and a bit of advice to support these anxieties. And as you mentioned there, the most important thing, I think, is your car. So cars are supposed to be driven. A lot of them might have been put on the side of the road or in a driveway for, you know, up to a year, 14 months maybe. And so, you know, really make sure you get your checks done. You might need to check an MOT. You might need to definitely check the tires, the battery, you know, fluid for the windscreen, you know, things like that. Because if you are nervous about getting in the car and beautiful sunny day, and then suddenly you've got there, and that could, you know, all these little things that could add up to making that journey not so pleasurable. And there is something really lovely about driving when you get your confidence back of especially when we've been shackled up for so long, that freedom, that sense of freedom when you're behind the wheel and you put your favorite songs on and you've got the window down, and oh, it's just a wonderful, wonderful feeling. But it's amazing how nervous people are to get to that point. But I get it. I totally get it. You know, what we've all been through in the last year has been, you know, it's been terrifying. And so, yes, we just want to kind of get people's confidence back, get them back out on the road, but in a safe and you know, in a good way. And I suppose if someone's really worried about, and they've got a big journey to do because everything is lifting, you know, you might be going back to work, you might be wanting to see your loved ones that you haven't seen for a long time, or, you know, in a month's time, we might be traveling or you know, doing a staycation. And you might have a 3 or 4 hour journey to Cornwall or something like that. So if you're nervous about that, I advise the drivers to maybe start with baby steps. So go out and do a little small circuit of familiar roads, and then just build that confidence. Don't kind of throw yourself in the deep end of not doing anything and then suddenly having to do this big journey and it, you know, just being horrible, rather than a really lovely experience of that we're allowed out and to do something lovely rather than get the shopping.
That's the whole notion of anxious drivers do not good drivers actually make. You need to have a certain amount of caution, certainly, but it needs to be sensible and backed up by that. So what would your top tips be, Jodie, in terms of actually ensuring that anybody who's listening to this who might be a bit concerned about the whole thing saying, yeah, the MOT's due, I need to actually have a checkup, go to a reputable garage, presumably, and get the thing sorted?
Yes, absolutely. Check your paperwork. Make sure the car's running, it's got its oil, it's got its, you know, everything is happy and the car's happy and the tire pressure is good and all those little things. Then you can start concentrating on yourself, build your confidence. Start small, start baby steps, you know, and then just work your way up. And then I suppose the other really important thing is actually talking to the more confident drivers out there, that, you know, people are really worried. They're coming out of this unprecedented, really scary time where we've been staring at the same four walls for, you know, over a year, and just leaving the front door might be really daunting or might be really frightening. So, you know, that, let alone getting in, you know, behind the wheel. So don't give people space. Don't be, you know, up their rear end. Don't be honking their horn. Don't be, you know, doing stupid overtaking maneuvers. Really just be slightly kinder, be more conscientious on the road, be more conscious of other drivers. So I'm kind of talking from both sides. I'm talking to the more confident drivers to really just be respectful, and to the ones that are slightly more nervous, just don't worry. We're going to look after you. Just take baby steps and you will get there. And then there's going to be, you'll have that wonderful moment of loving, falling in love with driving again, because there's that freedom that we haven't had is, you know, it's right at your fingertips.
Well, Jodie, in an era in which clearly it's often seems as though we're having people saying, you can't drive, you shouldn't drive, think about the carbon footprint and various other elements within that. I think you maybe sort of introduced a whole new world in terms of concepts with that. Because, of course, this is the decade that we'll be gradually seeing the shift to electric cars on a regular basis, no doubt.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And there's it's been wonderful for the planet with you know, literally no aeroplanes, no traffic in the last year. And, you know, the one negative is that, unfortunately, people are going to be more hesitant about getting on public transport. So I can imagine seeing a lot more cars on the road, which is not great, not good for the environment at all. But then there is this big push from the manufacturers and from the more kind of motoring side, where they are making a lot more electric vehicles, making hybrid vehicles. And, you know, more people might be interested in buying a new car. And if you are, definitely look at the hybrid, the electric vehicle route, because that's where we're going to have to be. And that a lot of manufacturers have vowed by in the 2020, 25, I think, we're all going to have to be driving vehicles like that, which we have to do, because we have to look after our beautiful planet as well.
Jodie, it's been, as we knew it was going to be, always wonderful. It's always great to connect with you. So good to see you, as I say, using this magical world of Zoom. It's great on that side of things there. Keep on keeping on. And just remind people where people can go to actually find out further details about this co-op survey and so on. Where should they actually head?
Yes, well, they can go to the website, which is a co-op, but it's co-opinsurance.co.uk. And that will tell you more about the survey.
Splendid. We've got two final questions for you, Jodie. I think you probably know what they are, but they're the usual. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Have I had a Zoomer?
Well, that's what I'm using as a definition of what we're doing now. We're having a Zoomer, effectively.
Oh, this is called a Zoomer now. Nice. I like Zoomers. I mean, thank goodness for Zoomering. And being able to see wonderful faces.
Well, exactly. Again, I think the next step is obviously to put you together on a joint Zoomer with Liz Brewer and indeed Jack, your wonderful sort of polo playing brother as well. It would all work together there.
Yes, exactly. Oh my God.
Final crucial question is, will you return?
Absolutely, 100%.
Jodie, absolute delight as ever. Take care, keep on keeping on, and bye for now.
Take care. Thank you so much.
So with a world in which, as we've just heard from Jodie Kidd, people are obviously getting back into the travel scenario. They're taking those initial steps forward to moving on in all sorts of ways, driving their cars and so on. What about our furry friends? What about seeing our pets? It would seem that actually more British folk are actually looking forward to seeing pets more than family after holidays and so on, which is very important from that point of view. And indeed, with half the population already feeling guilty about leaving their pets, we've got a number of issues that are coming to the fore within this whole side of things, or indeed coming to the poor, one might well say. To talk about this particular aspect, we're delighted to welcome animal psychic and ace author, the wonderful Jackie Weaver. How are you, Jackie?
Hello, I'm absolutely fine, thank you.
So clearly we've got an awful lot of potentially concerned pets, and they see their owners have been very much in the same lockdown environment for them, in some cases for months at a time, etc. That could be changing. And in terms of the pandemic, that relationship between our furry friends and ourselves is going to come under increasing scrutiny.
Absolutely. And I've actually been doing quite a bit of work on that recently, because, you know, people, they look on their animals as basically like children, which to me is completely normal. However, the circumstances of spending so much time together that a lot of the animals, you know, have become very reliant on company. So people are now panicking that when they obviously start going away and start going back out to work and things like that, that the animals are going to be seriously affected.
Now, in terms of that, looking at the line forward, obviously pets are sensitive in all sorts of ways. Do you think, you know, more and more of us will be actually angling to have pets at work day, or indeed actually taking their pets on holiday with them?
Well, I'd say if you can take a pet to work, fabulous. That's great because it's a lovely, you know, interactive environment for them. Yes, I intend to take my dog on holiday. However, as you know what one going abroad would not be so easy. But in Britain, some of the places you can't take pets. A lot of the places are really, really booked up now. And the other point is that some of these pets like this been quite, I think it's, I don't know if it's even 3 million new pets to people in Britain in lockdown. A lot of them have not been socialised because of lockdown. So therefore, to take them to a busy environment would actually probably be a huge backward step, because like a puppy, on principle, even though they may be a year old, you need to do things gradually to get them used to it. So, you know, this is why I think Trusted House Sitters actually did the survey, because, you know, of how people are thinking about their animals. So I come from the animal side thinking, actually, you're probably safer at this point to keep them in your own environment and just work carefully from there.
And change can obviously heighten anxiety in all mammals, whatever kind of species we happen to be. Can you just share with us in terms of how Trusted House Sitters can actually provide a solution to this by ensuring that actually pets can still actually be in their own home, as opposed to not only missing their owners and their best friends and keepers and so on, but also put into a completely strange alien environment to them as well?
Yes, they've come up with a really good concept and the way it works, and it's been working for, you know, quite a long time now. But it's people that are absolutely passionate about animals, and often it's people that have had their own animals but they've gone to heaven and maybe they've decided I'm not going to have another dog or whatever, so they actually go and stay in these people's houses. So the beauty of it is the house sitter is also getting the animal as company and being able to give attention to that animal, and that animal gets attention from them. So it's a real win-win situation. And needless to say, they're completely, you know, vetted and checked out. And the other beauty of it, which I found from my own experience now, is that my cat is actually epileptic. He's not, he's diabetic. So he needs injected every day. So that's a really, I was thinking, what am I going to do? But fortunately, they have people that, you know, are experienced in that, because they maybe had a, you know, a diabetic cat. So people like that can then come to your home, stay with your pet and inject them every day as they need to be. So that's dear Andy.
Do you think that that'll actually obviously provide peace of mind, not only for the owners, but for the pets themselves in terms of the experience?
Yes, I would say so, to keep them in their own environment and just have people that are absolutely, you know, knowledgeable, loving. And yes, I just think that especially for the owners, I'm just thinking, oh, you know, thank goodness I've got somebody that actually knows what they're doing, because, you know, it's a big ask. And some animals, you know, say have epilepsy, so they will have fits. Well, if you've had a dog yourself that's had fits, then you get used to it. But if you haven't, it would be a big fright. So again, if you're going away and you're leaving somebody, you know, that is experienced in that, you think, okay, they know what to do as well, they're used to it. And that's a huge weight off people's shoulders.
And in terms about being a pet psychic, Jackie, I mean, I have to ask the question, how is that something which you developed, which you suddenly kind of found that you had the gift for that? How did that sort of suddenly follow your particular life path?
Well, basically, it's been there all my life, but like lots of other people, I didn't recognise it. So even as a child, I'd know things. So I'd say something to my mother and she'd go, how do you know that? I go, I don't know, but I do. So, of course, you, as a child, you can't work out how you know it, but you know it. So as I went on in life and I asked people these questions, like, do you have dreams that come true? Do you, you know, suddenly find yourself going, do you know, I knew that was going to happen. It's because our psychic part of our brain is open. And it's just another part of your brain that can receive information. So back in 2005, I got very, very ill. And basically, they didn't think I was going to make it. And that completely changed my life path. Open my mind up. Another communicator came to chat to my animals, told me I could do this, showed me how to do it, and I've been doing it ever since. And I teach people as well. So it's something that actually is not as strange as people think.
Well, I would certainly recommend animalpsychic.co.uk as one useful website to actually check out, including obviously Chico and Bucky, or Buddy, I should say, Buddy. Basically.
Yeah.
They were actually there. What wonderful stuff.
Two little dudes.
Precisely. But in terms of, I say, this house sitting scenario, where would you point people if they wish to find out further information about pet sitting environment and so on? Where should they go?
I would go into the Trusted House Sitters website. There's loads of information. And, you know, I think it's just all there for you to read and make your own mind up. And peace of mind is what all us pet owners are looking for.
Jackie Weaver, our pet psychic extraordinaire. Huge thanks. Be well, be safe, and be happy, Jackie.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.